SIS 105, Fall 2010, and this is the third of the four lectures on IR theory, which should give us the basic working theoretical vocabulary that we can use in the rest of the semester. We've done realism, we've done liberalism, so what I want to do today is I want to spend a little bit of time talking about the third kind of school of IR theory, which is called constructivism. Now, constructivism is in many ways not like realism or liberalism. It's kind of different and broader in certain ways. Constructivism is really more of a mood or a sensibility or a certain set of wagers about the way social life is put together, and it starts at the broad social theoretical level and only then kind of makes its way into IR. Now, realism and liberalism do the same thing. They're sort of general theories that then make their way into world politics in particular. But that tendency is even more pronounced in constructivism. And part of the reason for that is because constructivism is really the youngest major IR theoretical approach. Really, this comes from sets of insights that were developed in international law and in the field of sociology. So, in the way that a lot of liberal thought comes from things that happen in economics, the way that a lot of realist thought comes from things that happened in certain kinds of political history, constructivism really comes from international law and from sociology, so different kinds of origins. And it's really only been around for about two decades. You didn't find people calling themselves constructivists before about the early 1990s, which is really only a couple of decades ago, compared to the number of people throughout history and the length of time people have been calling themselves realists and liberals, which you have to reckon in the hundreds of years. Constructivism is a little blip. This is something very new, but it has gotten quite a bit of attention. And in fact, if you go to a major professional conference of international relations scholars these days, you will find that most of the panels, most of the papers being presented, are dealing with the sorts of issues that constructivists raise. So this has a lot of bearing in the scholarly world at the moment and is starting to work its way out into other things in ways that we'll talk about a little bit. Now, one of the early advocates of a constructivist way of doing work on international relations or a constructivist perspective on world politics was this gentleman named Alexander Wendt, and you're reading one of his very famous articles this week. But the first person who actually used the term in IR, the term was used before in the philosophy of science and it's been used in a couple of other places, the first time it was actually used in IR was in a book published in 1989 called World of Our Making, and the author was a gentleman by the name of Nicholas Onuf, and Professor Onuf was actually a professor here at AU, was actually a professor here in the School of International Service. So, in many ways, constructivism was born here, even though if you were to ask most IR people these days where constructivism came from, they would probably mention Alex Wendt, because he quickly became sort of the most person who's most prominently associated with that label. So what exactly does constructivism hold? What are the basic tenets of constructivism? This is a very hard question, because as a new, relatively new theory, it hasn't had as much time for people to sort of work out what the real essential propositions of a constructivist way of doing things are. But we could sort of take a stab at it, contrasting with realism and liberalism. We might come up with something like this. Constructivists argue, or constructivist wager, is probably a better way to say this, that history is not an inevitable progression and it's not the same thing one after the other, but history is contingent, history is mutable, history is changeable. So there's an awful lot of change in constructivist accounts. Constructivists would also argue, contrary to both realists and liberals, that the kinds of goals that states have emerge from the identity that that state has. So a lot of things in constructivist research deal with the ways in which states and state leaders and state populations conceptualize themselves and understand themselves in the world and understand the sort of role that they play, and that translates into the sorts of goals that they have in terms of their foreign policy. as a consequence of this, when constructivists think about anarchy, they do not think of the kind of thing that realists will point to, sort of this empty anarchy in which balancing happens. And liberals will point to anarchy as being a permissive condition for people to strike rational bargains with each other. For constructivists, anarchy, international anarchy, is thick. There are a lot of rules and norms that are going on out there in international politics, and those things have to be taken seriously if you are a constructivist. And then a final point or proposition that constructivists would generally assent to is the idea that institutions and organizations, again, things floating around out there in the international arena, provide not just coordination, the way liberals would have it, but provide governance without government, provide a certain kind of authority, even though it's not necessarily linked to a sovereign state or something along those lines. So those are the basic kinds of tenets of constructivism. What I want to do now is I want to elaborate briefly on each of these and give some examples and try to make clearer what it means to sort of see world politics in a constructivist way. So let's think here about the notion of change, which is very important to a constructivist account. The way we could say this abstractly is that for constructivists, stability is not presumed the way it tends to be for either realists or liberals. To be in the international system, to have an international system, if you are a constructivist, takes work, takes social effort to produce things that are relatively stable. Instead of starting out with the idea that, you know, there just is this thing called the international system and we just have to figure out how to live in it, constructivists would say, well, there's a lot of effort that goes into making these things happen. They don't just occur naturally. On one hand, this means things could have been different. It means we didn't have to have the kind of organization of world politics that we have right now. But it also means they still could be different. It means that because there's nothing natural about the way we presently organize world politics, that world politics could actually be organized in a radically different way in the future. That's a lot at stake in this idea that these things are produced by social action rather than being natural facts. Constructivists would argue that everyday practices, everyday behaviors, everyday ways of acting and interacting is where you look to see how stability is actually produced. So a constructivist thinking about, say, a university might say, universities are not natural facts. They are not given in the nature of things. The fact that there continues to be an American university day after day is a social product. It takes work. There have to be lots of things that people do to maintain American university, and not just in a physical sense of like somebody's got to take out the trash, but in kind of a cultural sense, in a social sense, there have to be procedures of figuring out where the boundary lines of American university are. There have to be ways of administering people using the category of student, not student. There have to be all kinds of little ways in which in your daily life you and everybody else at the university end up reproducing the existence of this particular social arrangement, because there's nothing natural about it. If all the people were to disappear, then there would be no university. The university is dependent on social actions that take it into account. For instance, you can't just walk into the library and pick up a book. You have to show your ID card and check it out. That is one of those everyday practices that reinscribes the university, right? That reproduces the university, that you have to take it into account when you go and pick books out of the library. Those are the sorts of things that create the effect of the stable American university. Constructivists would say the same thing happens in world politics writ large. So let's think about a case from a few years ago. Augusto Pinochet, who was a dictator in Chile, and stepped down at a certain point. Long story that we're not going to go into right now, but eventually Pinochet's dictatorship comes to an end, and he stops being the dictator of Chile. And of course, as many dictators do, he had managed to give himself sovereign immunity before leaving office, so he was not prosecutable within Chile for any of his alleged crimes against his people, many of which were extremely well documented. So he gave himself immunity, so he didn't have to worry about these things. Now, he was very ill and went to Britain for a medical procedure. And when he set foot in Britain, Spain, which often likes to think of itself as having a certain special responsibility for things that go on in Latin American countries. Spain asked Britain to extradite Pinochet to them so they could put him on trial for various violations of domestic law and international law, including crimes against humanity. So they said, you know, Britain, please send him to us. We'll try him. Now, part of the reason why this is so important and why this is such an interesting example of this is because it really poses the question of what sovereignty means. Because if Chilean sovereignty means that the dictates of what Chile has to say are valid within its borders and for its citizens, then the fact that Pinochet had sovereign immunity would mean that Pinochet was non-prosecutable. But here we have a situation in which people were challenging this, and essentially the Spanish claim was human rights law trumps this kind of sovereign immunity. So they asked Britain to extradite. Now the British ended up saying that they could extradite, but they're not going to. They're not going to because Pinochet is an old person and he's very ill. They're going to show charity, mercy, whatever. What's interesting about this decision is it reinscribes certain kinds of things, certain understandings about international politics in everyday practice. Basically, by Britain saying it had the right to extradite, a small but important shift in the limits of sovereignty or the capacity of sovereign actors to do things has been affected. Because now, if Britain could extradite based on this, if Britain has that right, then that means that sovereign states don't have the ability to immunize their former dictators from international law. So there's a sort of cascade effect associated with it. If the British court had decided something else, if they decided they had no right to extradite because of sovereignty, that also would have reinscribed a certain understanding of sovereignty in everyday practice. Constructivists would argue that it's exactly these kinds of moments, these kinds of everyday decisions, these everyday activities that produce the greater kinds of social aggregates that we actually end up seeing in the world. And we have to investigate how those things happen in order to figure out what's going on in world politics. And one of the ways constructivists like to do this is by pointing out that if you take these sorts of everyday practices seriously, then you're very quickly going to run into state identity as an important source of the reasons why states do things. State identity pertains to who a state and its people are, but also, therefore, what they can do legitimately. Because we are a certain kind of people, we will do a certain sort of thing. Now, for constructivists, that's not just a result of material factors, and it's certainly not just the result of genetic factors or something. A group of people is not a particular way because of just some set of ethnic characteristics or whatever. That's not the issue. It's not how constructivists would tend to argue this. And it's not just because they happen to live together or whatever. Instead, identity is intersubjective, right? It doesn't exist out there in the world, and it doesn't exist inside your head. It exists in the social practices that people have with each other. You know there's an identity, because when people deal with each other, they deal with each other on the basis of belonging to the same category or to different categories. So we know that there is a Kurdish identity, because we see Kurds interacting with Kurds and non-Kurds and treating them differently. Right? Identity gives rise to interests. Identity for a constructivist comes before interests. Because we are a certain kind of people, because we are a certain kind of community, therefore we can and should do something else. So, you know, the United States articulation, because we are the paragon of liberty, therefore, we should not interfere in the political affairs of the world, but we should keep ourselves to be the purest example of democracy, so we can lead by example. Or, because we are the most powerful country in the world, we have an obligation to send our troops into different parts of the world where people are experiencing hardship and use our great strength to support them in their struggles for freedom or whatever. Both of those kinds of things get said in presidential speeches and congressional speeches all the time. Those are identity arguments. They all have the form, because we are X, we can or should do Y. Those are the kind of things constructivists would look at. They would very much look at those sorts of arguments and say it's those arguments, which is really what world politics is about. about those kinds of claims and struggles between people making different kinds of identity claims. And this is in particularly this is important in world politics because identities are always about selves, right? They're about us. But identities also imply others who are not self. They're outside someplace. So to say we are a certain thing is, at the same time, quite immediately, to say they are not whoever they happen to be. And why this has become so politically important is because different others have to be treated differently by different kinds of selves. Saying that some group has certain characteristics and you don't, well, that affects how you're going to deal with them. For instance, imagine there are a group of people who practice a religion that we are not all that cognizant of, and they engage in acts that we find kind of strange. It makes a difference whether we consider those people to be heretics or terrorists or primitives. It makes it, or something else. I'll just list those three out as possibilities here. All right, considering them, the others, in that light, right, figuring them or configuring them in that particular way, there are different kinds of implications, right? What do you do with heretics? Well, you either burn them or you try to convert them. What do you do with terrorists? Well, you don't really convert them. You don't really burn them for their heresy. I mean, I suppose you go after them and you kill them, or you try to prosecute them as criminals. Right? It's a different sets of options. Primitives, what do you do with primitives? Well, they're primitive. You either cordon them off and let them live in their pristine state of non-modernity or something, or you help to modernize them. You help to develop them. But you wouldn't develop terrorists, and you wouldn't develop heretics. All right, so how that self-other relationship is configured has different kinds of political implications all the way across. The self-other relationship is key for constructivists, and if they want to try to understand what's going on in world politics, they would first look to the kind of self-other relationships that are in force. And if you look at the sum total of all of these kinds of self-other relationships and the various implications to which they give rise out there in the world, you come up, at the end of the day, with something like international society, is a term constructivists very much like. In international society, right, it's international because you've got states floating around. States are sovereign, they recognize one another, and you have some territoriality, so we know where my authority starts and your authority stops. But these states, which are independent of each other, and everybody, each state then has their own inside and outside, their own selves and their own groups of others that they're dealing with, these states still have to do business with one another. They still do live on the same planet. They have enough interaction with each other that they actually occasionally need to do things together. One of the implications of this for constructivists is that this is how states spin international law. It is a way of making a set of agreements that everybody can live with. It's based on the proposition that only sovereigns can bind themselves, so the practice of states can become law. In fact, one of the main sources of international law is the behavior of states. And if all states are doing a certain thing, then it is entirely possible to say that therefore, because everybody has consented to it, it is now a matter of law. That's one of the main sources where international law comes from, is everyday state practice. But if you think about it, constructivists say, in international society, you've got law, other sorts of institutions, you've got states and identities, you've got lots of self-other relationships. It's a very complicated, kind of buzzing, exciting place. International society is thick anarchy. Not thin anarchy the way it is in realism, where it's just, ooh, there's no superior government, and therefore we all have to take care of our own security. We're going to balance against each other by building up forces. It leads to conflict spirals, leads to arms races, so on and so forth. And it's not even the liberal anarchy in which you have the opportunity to strike mutually beneficial deals with each other. So everybody's running around sort of comparing their utility functions and saying, if I ally with you or I make a deal with you, that's going to make us all richer. Okay, so make us all better off. Good. Constructivist anarchy is a lot thicker. There are rules and norms and other things floating around out there that you have to deal with. And in particular, the sorts of things you have to deal with, The ones that are really well established are what constructivists refer to as international institutions, by which they don't necessarily mean organizations. Right? International institution in this sense uses the word institution in a more sociological sense. One of the prime institutions that constructivists like to point to is the institution of the balance of power, which for a constructivist, a balance of power is a management strategy. It's a way that particular great powers manage the international system. It is something that you strive for deliberately. Remember in realism that the balance of power isn't necessarily deliberate. It's kind of the inevitable consequence of states looking to take care of their own security needs. You end up with a balance. In constructivism, to the contrary, a balance of power is something that everybody strives for. It's an institution of international society. It's a means or a procedure for dealing with various shifts in capabilities. Countries get rich, countries get poor, countries have bigger armies, countries have smaller armies, right? So power is moving around. The capacity of states, the physical attributes are moving around. Balance of power is one way of dealing with these shifts. Balance of power, the way a constructivist understands it, doesn't just mean that states are roughly equal to each other in terms of their capabilities. It also means that if one state does something and it's going to somehow be infringing on another state, then that other state needs to get some compensation. The other state requires some kind of a pay for standing back and allowing, you know, somebody to expand in Africa and gain more colonies or something like that. Europeans used to do this a lot amongst themselves. And as I've had occasion to mention before, I think one of the main things that happened for compensation was the great game called Let's Take Another Piece of Poland, in which various great powers would carve out little slivers of Poland and take that as compensation for whatever else was going on. And the idea of consideration was built into this too, the idea that great powers needed to be consulted before you went ahead and did anything. So the point is that the balance of power for a constructivist who's thinking about this in terms of international society is very closely linked to the identity of a great power, what it means to be a great power. If you are a constructivist of this variety, is that a great power is involved in and gets consulted when these things occur, is involved in actively managing the way the system works, and is entitled to compensation if other people get more powerful so that you can keep up with them. So, self-other relations, identities, international institutions. Now, another one that constructivists are sometimes fond of talking about is actually war, which, as we've seen, realists and liberals also like to talk about, but constructivists talk about it a little bit differently. War, if you are a constructivist, is not just use of deadly force. War is a social institution, an international institution. Constructivists would first point to the fact that we have laws that govern it. We have Geneva Conventions. Right, we have practices and codes about how war is supposed to be done. We have norms. We have sort of binding sets of expectations, social expectations, like don't deliberately kill civilians, don't deliberately target civilians, make sure you're only actually killing the other person's army rather than their civilian population. So we have that in there as a kind of established norm. We have various kinds of practices like the IRC, the International Committee of the Red Cross. And the International Red Cross has the very odd ability to drive onto active battlefields and tend the wounded. And this is very strange, because lots of countries respect the International Red Cross, or the International Red Crescent, in Islamic countries. So you have this this interesting practice that many states adhere to, which is that you can actually let the Red Cross in the middle of your battle, which is very strange, and you won't shoot at them, also very strange, and you'll actually let them tend the soldiers who are wounded from the other side, not just yours. Very, very odd. So again, constructivists would say, yeah, it's because war is a social institution. It's not just something people do. It's not just something people engage in with no limits. War itself is regulated and has social meaning attached to it. And, of course, the fact that we have war crimes, the fact that people can be prosecuted for violating certain kinds of ethical and normative boundaries within war is another thing constructivists would point to. So all of this adds up, these points about war, points about balance of power, they all add up to the idea that international institutions that exist out there in international society provide sets of standards that states can be held accountable to. So think about the example we've used earlier about the speed limit. Having a speed limit of 65 miles an hour does not, in fact, guarantee that everybody goes 65 miles an hour. However, it does give the police the authority to pull somebody over if they come breezing through there at 90 miles an hour. International institutions provide expectations. They do not provide a guarantee of specific behavior. And that's important to keep in mind. People will sometimes say international law isn't really worth all that much because there's nobody enforcing it, and states violate international law all the time. Now, an international lawyer or other kinds of constructivists would argue that that's approximately the same thing as saying that there must not be a law against murder because there are still murders committed. Of course there are. That's not the point. The point is the law establishes a certain set of expectations and a standard. You know, don't murder people. And then people do when they get prosecuted for it. And so the cynic would say, ah, international law, who punishes them? And the international lawyer or other constructivists would turn around and say, often states do it themselves. Somebody violates international law, states get together and say, hey, you know what, we're going to invade them because they violated international law. They're killing their own citizens, they're starving them, they're doing whatever. So the enforcement mechanism may actually be what states themselves do. Point being that this is how anarchy works if you're a constructivist. There are these thick normative notions out there, these thick cultural pieces of legitimacy, that's really what international life is about. And just as you have the possibility for large-scale historical change in constructivism, you also have the possibility of identities changing in various ways. States and their leaders and their populations can be socialized. They can be taught, in effect, to adhere to certain kinds of norms. They can be placed in particular positions from which they conclude various things and act accordingly. There's a mechanism, Wendt talks about this a little bit, but there's others who've gone into it in even more detail. There's a mechanism called altercasting. The way altercasting works is that you start treating the other the way that you would like the other to actually be, and then the other starts responding because you haven't given them many other choices. So, treating the Soviet Union as if it was, in fact, no longer the evil communist empire, but was, in fact, a poor country that was looking for friendship with the United States, might actually help to produce that situation, because you structure various kinds of actions accordingly around that notion. And so that kind of socialization goes on in world politics, constructivists say. You can also see this when a country joins the European Union, because a country joining the European Union has to take on a whole series of regulations called the Acquis Communautaire, and it's a big, thick document of all the European Union decisions that they have to somehow implement into their domestic legal structure. And that's a relatively formal kind of process where you get socialized because you have to adhere to certain things. There's also kind of an informal process of socialization, you know, becoming civilized, because there's really no central office for where civilized is determined, not like the European Union where there is a central office and it's in Brussels. Civilized is a little bit harder to figure out whether you've actually quote-unquote made it, right? Whether you're actually now within this thing called the Club of Civilized. But the same basic process is at work, which is states take on various expectations that they find floating around out there in the environment. Constructivists also argue that, you know, if identity changes from the outside with socialization, it can also change from the inside. Constructivists say identity can change when you get shifts in domestic political balances. And that's not just about interest groups, not just about the influence that they have. It's about the fact that different groups domestically within a state, say constructivists, have very different visions of what the state identity actually is. Because again, state identity is not naturally given. And because it's not naturally given, it takes work to sustain. It takes social practice. Different groups being in charge will have different social practices. And if they have different social practices, it stands to reason that the state that they are part of will end up with different identities and different kinds of interests. And not everybody in the state may agree, and that's why there may continue to be contestation. There may be a future election within the state about this to try to resolve the controversies in question. That's what constructivists say, you know, is going on when we actually have elections and such. And then finally, constructivists say identities can also change. Externally, they change through socialization. Internally, they can change through shifts in governing blocks, governing parties. They can also change through the advocacy of what are called TSMs, or transnational social movements. So you have a social movement like the campaign to ban landmines, or a social movement like there was a very good example a number of years ago. It was a group called Jubilee 2000, which then morphed into an organization called Dump the Debt. And basically their argument was there should be forgiveness of loans. And they did not so much as Dump the Debt, they became much more of an interest group. But when they were Jubilee 2000, they were linked up with a series of churches. And they staged huge rallies and demonstrations and such, saying we should forgive debt so countries don't have as much poverty to deal with. Or the campaign to ban landmines, the campaign for corporate social responsibility, various kinds of campaigns where people have gotten riled up and they've gone out and demonstrated and they've voted and so on and so forth based on these sets of international norms to which they wanted their state to adhere. So it's kind of a hybrid path between socialization from the outside and domestic political shifts, because you get domestic political shifts that are directly as a result of these sorts of new normative contexts in which states find themselves. So that's how identities change if you're constructivist, and it's very important because a lot of things are anchored in how the state thinks of itself. And if identity change is one of the main things constructivists like to look at, another one that they really like to look at is what's called global governance, which is the idea that when states are involved in international arrangements, it's not just some kind of instrumental bargain that they strike, but that international organizations actually have shared principles, shared norms. And what that leads to, a group of states who are involved with an international organization all kind of share the norm that that international organization is founded on. What you end up with is what some have called governance without government. These organizations actually have authority, not just control. And they're not just ways of coordinating actions between states, but they actually have their own authority as a result of the shared norms that they rest on, which are adhered to by all the various parties. So, for instance, think about the United Nations. And the United Nations has the ability to create something as a peacekeeping mission that wasn't a peacekeeping mission before. Yesterday you were just troops in a foreign country, today you're part of a UN mission. Why you're part of a UN mission is because a vote was taken and all of a sudden now you get to wear blue helmets and you have a different flag and you get to write the letters UN on all your vehicles and things like this. That is because, constructivists would say, the UN has authority, and it is the authority of the UN that does this. UN sanctioned for peacekeeping missions, very important kind of thing. The IMF, one of the things it gets to do is it gets to decide who's creditworthy and how creditworthy they are. And constructivists would say that's not just a technical decision, that's a political decision, that's a cultural decision. And recognizing someone as a particular kind of economic health, recognizing some country as being the place you can lend money to or a place you can't lend money to, which has all kinds of implications. Those things, however, right, that declaration, that determination, is not made by another state, but it's made by a very large international organization. And you want to go one step further in terms of what international organizations are actually capable of. One of the things that the IMF has available to it are what are called SDRs. SDRs are special drawing rights. It's effectively an IOU that the IMF writes to a particular country. So a country comes to the IMF and says, we have problems, we can't pay our debts back. Well, the IMF might actually choose to give that country, instead of actual money, would give it some of these IOUs, some of these SDRs, special drawing rights. That's technically what SDR stands for. And the country might use the SDRs as a way of paying back their debt to other countries. So basically what the IMF has just done is it has invented its own currency. Think about that for a second. An international organization inventing its own currency in a world where all the important decisions are supposed to be taken by sovereign territorial states. There, constructivists say, that's exactly because we live in a system that has lots of rules. We live in a system where you have governance without government. We live in a system where IOs are actually tremendously important. Now, global governance isn't just limited to interstate organizations. It also encompasses various non-state actors of various kinds. And I think about big global movements like Amnesty International, right, which is part of global governance to the extent that Amnesty is able to issue these reports that everybody listens to, that countries listen to, and it helps to regulate what countries can and cannot legitimately do. And that, say constructivists, is only possible because those international organizations actually have authority. Otherwise, if they just had control, then somebody would say, I'm not going to do this. But instead, having authority means that you can actually make certain claims about human rights, and they may be followed. They help to sort of set the standard for what good human rights practice actually is. So non-state actors are important pieces of global governance as well. Now, one thing constructivists think happens sometimes in international politics is that you get a set of states that identify with each other so strongly that they no longer really think of war amongst themselves. They no longer think of war between themselves as being really a live possibility. So if constructivists think that norms and international institutions matter, and if they think that organizations can have various kinds of authority, they also think that states can form security communities, where states have this positive identification with each other. This is another form of how that self-other relationship works itself out. States in a security community regard all of the other states in the community as self rather than as other, or certainly as closer to self. So they say, hey, you know, we're all on the same team. So disputes should be resolved peacefully. In fact, we should work together to make these things happen. Whatever the sorts of things that we need to have happen, right? Whether we're talking about development or whether we're talking about some sort of collaboration to solve a persistent problem with, you know, fisheries that lie between our two countries or something. Who knows? But these things should be resolved peacefully. And that's sort of what happens inside the security community. A positive collaboration on things is definitely envisioned. Being in a security community, and part of the reason why constructivists are so interested in the phenomenon of security communities, is because it really changes the context of how your interaction works. Right? If there's someone who's your friend, and they say something that pisses you off, then you're probably going to give them the benefit of the doubt, saying that they maybe had a bad day, and you'll ask them for an explanation or whatever. Some total stranger says exactly the same thing, and your reaction is likely to be, well, screw you, I don't have any use for you anyway. So being in a community with someone changes how you react to what it is that they do. Right, friendship, marriage is another good example. If you're married to somebody, the expectation is that if you are arguing with them, you'll do it sort of in the context of the marriage and it won't get too bad. Now, of course, if it does, then the marriage tends to get dissolved, which is what divorce is for, right? The ending of that particular status, because the status itself changes the context of things. Right? You treat your friends differently than you treat other people. Be honest, you do. You treat your friends differently than you treat other people, because we work in categories, and we think in these kinds of bounded categories as we try to figure out what's going on in the world. And so being in a security community changes the context of interaction. If I'm annoyed about something another state has done, I'm not going to think about going to war with them. I'm going to think about peacefully resolving what's going on between us. So how do you do this? How do you create a community at the international level? Well, constructivists have argued for many years one way to do this is with increased transaction between private citizens, people kind of dealing with each other commercially, but also people just having exchanges where they know about one another. So you think about the Fulbright program or the Rotary Scholarships program or any other kind of study abroad experience. One of the functions of that, say constructivists, is simply to have more interaction between private citizens so people know more about each other and therefore they can help to perhaps form a community. higher levels of trade, higher levels of communication, those are tremendously important because they start actually integrating the way that two societies work. So they're actually connected to each other, which is sort of important. One other thing, though, that's really necessary if you're going to have this kind of security community, for the most part, you need some kind of a shared notion of community. You need some notion that we belong together so we can then spin a story about us, right? A story about us and our identity. I can't just make that up out of whole cloth. I have to use existing cultural resources to start building that story. There's a great example out there in the world, and that is the example of Europe, which constructivists love to point to. Constructivists say the idea that Europe is a community has been around for hundreds and hundreds of years. People have been talking about this, you know, since the Crusades, right? This idea that the countries in Europe, on the sort of little peninsula of Asia, right, that they all belong together and form some kind of natural unity. So that notion's been around, at least among intellectuals, for a very long time. There's quite a lot of interaction. High levels of interaction on different kinds of levels. I mean, not only were European countries at war with each other a lot, they also traded with each other a lot. They built railroad tracks across each other's boundaries. And there's a whole series of ways in which they've always been, pretty much for as long as they've existed, interacting with one another at a very, very high level. And after the Second World War, of course, we have a very deliberate attempt to eliminate the possibility of war between some of these states, particularly between France and Germany, who used to go to war all the time, right? I mean, France and Germany were at war more often than not for large portions of European history, and a lot of World Wars I and II involved the French and the Germans kind of being the front lines, respectively. After World War II, there's a very deliberate effort to say, no, we should reframe this so we're all part of the same community and we don't resolve our disputes with military force. And the European Union, originally the European Economic Community, and then grows up to being the European Community, and then the European Union, I mean, it's a whole interesting sort of history you can tell just by looking at the name change of what happens. But for a constructivist, the EU is not just about balancing against the Russians or anybody else, and it's not just about gains from trade, it's about a change in the identity of states and the populations of those states. Now, when constructivists then sit to look at the future, and they sort of speculate on what's going to happen out there in the world. See, if you're a realist and a liberal, you have a pretty good grasp of this, because the future will be pretty much like the past. For realists, the future will be exactly like the past because it's all pretty much the same thing against the same basic backdrop. And if you're a liberal, well, now that we have liberal democracy and rational bargaining, everything is going to be pretty much the same from here on out. Not so if you are a constructivist. If you are a realist or a liberal, then you can predict. You can predict what's going to happen. And in fact, the sorts of actions that human beings have are a little bit restricted. People are kind of caught up in the different restraints of the theory. So liberals have a particular understanding of what is valuable and a particular understanding of how people interact with what is valuable. And because of that assumption, liberals do not assume that in the future suddenly people will start acting radically differently. Right, that's not a proposition you can really put into liberal theory very easily. Or realists think states go and pursue their survival. They tend to think that that's just what's going to happen. And so that's just right there. You can predict. You make predictions based on the idea that states are actually going to balance. States are going to be pursuing their own survival. You can sort of figure out what's going to happen. Now, for constructivists, on the other hand, you can't do this quite as easily. You can't predict if you're a constructivist. The future's open. Lots of things can happen. It's not completely unrestricted. It's not like anything could happen, but there are lots of things that could happen. And a constructivist wants to remain sensitive to those kinds of contingencies. So a constructivist doesn't end up predicting things like this war will break out at this point in time, or something like that, or new great powers will inevitably arise to challenge the unipolarity of the system at the moment. That's a sort of forecast that you would get, you know, realist making or something. And instead of that kind of prediction, a constructivist would say, all you can do is forecast. You can come up with plausible scenarios about the future. And it is those plausible scenarios, say constructivists, that's about the best you can do. plausible scenarios just tease things out. And so we can't actually predict what's going to happen, but we can certainly envision a number of possibilities. And then perhaps if you're a policymaker, you could say, oh, well, those are the possibilities, and I want to figure out which one I actually want to defend against, or which one I actually want to take into account. Agency, which is to say the ability to do otherwise, the ability to do something different, remains really front and center for a constructivist account. Why we go one way rather than another has a lot to do with these unpredictable decisions that people will end up making. So it's hard to predict. Constructivists can't really predict what the future will hold. Now, constructivism, as I've sort of given you the broad sweep right now of what constructivist IR looks like, constructivism also comes in sort of two flavors, or has two different kinds of moods. There are what you might call liberal constructivists, who take these constructivist insights about identity, norms, self-other relations, boundaries, practices, etc., and they kind of graft that onto a basically liberal sensibility about rational bargaining, and come up with the idea that the world can be improved through the promulgation of the right kinds of norms. In fact, in many ways, the goal of a certain kind of liberalism is the transcendence of power struggle altogether. And liberal constructivists say, yes, that's actually possible. The reason that's possible is because all the things that lead to states striving against one another for more and more power, well, those are not naturally given things. Those things can be eliminated. So you can transcend the struggle for power, right, if you have the right kinds of norms. Now, the other mood of constructivists is the one that inclines much more closely to realism. And the way that a realist constructivist would articulate this would be that there is always conflict. There's always conflict in every kind of social relation. And so you're never going to transcend the power struggle. You're just going to change it into a different form, because at some level, all of this stuff is about power. That's what a realist constructivist would say. The power struggle is inescapable. You cannot run away from it. You cannot simply ignore it and pretend it's not there. You have to actually take seriously that when people are making these kinds of identity arguments or articulating certain understandings of the value of a particular place, what they're doing is they're helping to bring it about. They're helping to construct it against alternatives. That there is something conflictual in the very act of articulating these things. Power struggle is inescapable if you are a constructivist. It's just that it doesn't always get fought out on the material plane. Power struggle can also happen on the cultural and rhetorical and political plane. So that should give you a little bit of an overview of how constructivist IR theory works. And that should give you some guidelines for trying to make sense out of some of the readings, and we will talk more about this in class.